In order to understand this book, there are 66 chapters, and you have to take a look at the structure to give you a clue about separating the forest from the trees. So here is the forest. We're going to look at that first of all. And in your notes, you have two charts about this, one on page 106 and 107, and they're going to change up here, and I trust that between looking at 106 and 107, you can kind of fill in. There are two historical centers to the book, chapters 7 to 12 and 36 to 39 are history. They are stories. They are actual events of what happened. Now, what surrounds them are basically sermons, 1 to 6, 13 to 35, and 40 to 66. They are preaching. So these two historical centers or two events in history are deliberately crafted by the author to look very similar so that the reader will naturally compare them, and you're supposed to do that. They both involve kings of Judah. Ahaz is the father, Hezekiah is the son, obviously in different time periods. When Ahaz dies, his son becomes king, he has another historical situation similar to what his father had. In both of these situations, both with Ahaz and with Hezekiah, they both occur at the same place in the city of Jerusalem, at the Gihon Spring. And I'll talk to you in a minute why that's important. Both of them have a crisis which they're facing. Both Ahaz and Hezekiah are faced with the country of Assyria, which is headed down to gobble up their region. Both of them have a question put to them, will you trust God? Now, they answer this question differently. One does better than the other, but both of them ultimately fail. So that the way the structure of the book works is that as they answer this question badly, as both of them fail, what happens is the succeeding chapters after those stories are meant to speak to the failure. Like, here's the solution, here's what you should have done. If you'd considered this information, you might not have made such a bad decision. So you get the failure and the solution to both of these. They fail in different ways. That's why there are different solutions given. So what we have left then, after we take a look at the two historical centers and the solutions, is just chapters 1 through 6, which really is an introduction. And the introduction serves to, well, introduce the rest of the book, but also kind of picture it and picture the two major ideas right here. I'll show you what I'm talking about. Let's start with the introduction, and we will, first of all, under 1b, state the rebellion of the people. Probably some pretty familiar verses to you, pretty famous verses. Come now, let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they are red as crimson, they shall be like wool. So sins here are not black, they are considered red. And only as we wash those red sins red in blood do they come out white. It's not a very good laundry lesson, but it's a good theology lesson, if you know what I mean. If you're willing and obedient, you'll eat the best of the land, but if you resist and rebel, you'll be devoured by the sword, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. So the people are pretty rebellious, and judgment is coming, and here that rebellion is simply stated. In the next section, under 2b, the rebellion is illustrated with a picture. And the picture is that of a vine, something you should know about because Jesus talks about it in the New Testament. God pictures Israel like a vine that doesn't produce good fruit, and here's the way the passage goes. I will sing for the one I love a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. Everything about this passage is supposed to indicate why the plant should have done well. I mean, if you take a close look, you can figure them out. First of all, it's a fertile hillside, right? So things should have, this plant should have worked. Then it says, he dug it up and cleared it of stones. There are a lot of stones in Israel, and he took out all the stones to try to make sure the thing could grow well. Planted it with the choicest vines, not a bad vine, but a good vine. Then he built a watchtower in it. A watchtower is what you build so you can protect your harvest when the harvest comes in, because you anticipate a harvest. Same reason why you build a wine press, because you anticipate you're going to get, you know, grapes from this vine. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruits. So, you dwellers in Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done for my vineyard than I have done for it? And the answer, of course, is nothing. It's not God's fault here. When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? So what will I do? Here's what I will do. I will tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge and it will be destroyed. I'll break in its wall and it will be trampled. So you should see in here this double entendre. You should see, you know, not only speaking about this vineyard, but what does this mean in terms of the city as well? I will break in its wall and it will be trampled, right? Because the wall is the only thing that really protects the city, and you're going to see that happen here. So God says, because you have been rebellious, judgment will come, and Israel is pictured here as a vine. Now, fast forward 600 years later. 600 years later, it's a Thursday night, and it's Passover night, and Jesus spends the Last Supper, or his Passover, in the southern part of the city with his disciples. At the end of John chapter 14, he gets up, and they begin to walk to Gethsemane. In order to get to Gethsemane from the southern part of the city, you have to walk past the temple. Josephus tells us that on the side of the temple was a huge, beautiful fresco of a vine and grapes. And just as Jesus is passing by there, is probably when he says the words of John 15, I am the true vine, and my Father is the gardener. In the Old Testament, if you wanted to be connected with God, you did it through the nation of Israel. Now, I am the way people get connected to God. If you really want to know God, be connected to me and abide in me. So Jesus uses that figure and even translates it a little bit into the New Testament. So the rebellion is illustrated, and now what we want to do is take a look at 2C, the solution. So if in fact there is this rebellion, if there in fact there is this sin, what does one need to do to solve it? And here in a individual level in the life of Isaiah is the solution. Right? Here's what happens. The solution is the example of Isaiah's call. Right, again, a very famous passage, probably all of you heard of it before. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphs, each with six wings. Two wings they covered their faces, two they covered their feet, with two they were flying, and they were calling to one another, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty, the whole earth is full of his glory. Those creatures which are closest to God are just overwhelmed with God's holiness and the way there is no sin there. The very same way in the book of Revelation, when John sees Jesus, he falls down at his feet as though dead. And when you're in front of a holy God and you contemplate who God is and what he's like, you're astounded with his holiness, and then as you look at yourself, obviously your own sinfulness. And that's where we go next, because Isaiah says, Woe to me, I cried, I am ruined, for I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. Now, when he says that, he's not simply saying, you know, I have a real problem with cussing on the basketball court. Well, you really shouldn't cuss on the basketball court, but it's more than that. The New Testament and Jesus say to us, it's not what goes into a man which defiles him, but what? What comes out, and the idea is that your mouth expresses the intents and thoughts of your heart. So when he says, I'm a man of unclean lips, he's not just trying to say, I have trouble with my speech. He's also saying, I have trouble with my heart. I have a sinful, wicked heart, and God, I need your help. So he cries out to God and says, God, help me. I'm ruined. I'm a sinner. And so God responds to him. Then one of the seraphs flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he'd taken with the tongs on the altar, and he touched my mouth and said, See, this has touched your lips, your guilt is taken away, and your sin is atoned for. So in Isaiah's situation here, his solution, the solution for his life, is the same as the solution for the nation. That is, he recognizes he's a sinner, and he puts his trust in God. So if you want to be the kind of witness, you want to be the kind of servant you ought to be, the first thing you learn here in Isaiah's life is, you got to trust, okay? You put your trust in God, you ask him to take care of your sin, and he does. So if Isaiah is the example of a good servant, and he is, a good servant is defined by two things. Number one, he trusts. And then number two, then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send? Who will go for us? He said, Here am I, send my brother. No, here am I, send me. The second thing a good servant does is he tells. Now, normally, I don't know if I would have noticed that, if this is all I had, but when you compare this with the rest of the book, suddenly this stands out and you say, oh, a good servant trusts and he tells. It's a good summary, it's a good introduction to what's going to happen in the rest of the book. Okay? So, speaking of the rest of the book, let's take a look at it. So, the next major portion, 2a. Trust in Yahweh is the basis of servanthood. The foundation for being a servant is you got to trust, like we just saw. You can't be a servant of God, you can't be a witness for Him, if you don't trust Him. So, here is the historical situation. And things are going to get just a little bit heavy in geographical and historical, but stay with me, okay? I'll do my best to explain it to you. In chapter 7 to 12, we have that first historical center where the question is asked, should we trust God? And here's the way it's presented. Chapter 7, verse 1. When Ahaz, son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, was king of Judah. I try to color code these to help you out, all right? And you got to get these names now. The first name is Judah, and Ahaz, who is king of Judah. All right? So Ahaz is king of Judah. When he was king, King Rezin of Aram. Okay, so Rezin is the guy's name. Aram is the country. It's also called Syria. Not Assyria, but Syria. So write down Rezin and Syria. Rezin and Syria and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel. So connect Pekah with Israel. Right? Ahaz and Judah, Rezin and Syria, and then Pekah and Israel. You don't have to know their full names. His middle name was Boo, but we don't need to go there right now. Okay, just first names, Pekah and Israel. Here's the situation. It took somebody a while, but they got it. The last two marched up to fight against Jerusalem, but they could not overpower. Now, why did they do that? Here's why they did it. Here's what the map looks like at this time period. And Assyria is the 500-pound political gorilla because they do whatever they want to do and they go wherever they want to go and they're feeling like going southwest and conquering these territories down here. Well, there are a couple people in the way, namely Syria, and whose king is Rezin, and Israel, the northern 10 tribes, whose king is Pekah. And they decide, hey, Syria is so big and they are the superpower of the day. If we band together, perhaps we can stop them. So they decide to do that. But they also recognize that those two little nations, Syria and Israel, are not enough by themselves. They need more help. So they go to Judah and they say to Judah with Ahaz, hey, come help us. Judah says, no way, Mose. Right? He's not having a part of it. He's saying, listen, Assyria is a big bad gorilla, and they're coming down here. I'll just let you two guys get beat up, and you guys fight the battle, and you know, you guys can be the buffer zone between me and them. I don't want to get involved. And they say, not so easy. If you don't help us, we're going to turn on you. And that's exactly what they do. Okay, so that's the situation we find ourselves in here. Assyria is on the march. Syria and Israel say, you better help us, or we're going to wipe you out. And that's where we find Ahaz confronted with this question. Right, you with me? So here's the way it presents itself then. Now the house of David, that is the southern two tribes and the king, Ahaz and his family, was told Aram has allied itself with Ephraim. So the hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken as the trees of the forest are shaken by the wind. So Israel, Assyria, are coming against us. Bad news. They're bigger than we are. We're in deep trouble. What are we going to do? So that's when the Lord said to Isaiah, go out, you and your son, Shear Yashuv, to meet Ahaz at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the washerman's field. You say, where in the world is that? Why are they so specific? Well, the reason they're specific is because it becomes very easy to connect this with what happens to Hezekiah 30 chapters later. Right? It's a very specific spot. Let me show you where it is. It's a place called the Gihon Spring. If you take a look at the map of Jerusalem, it looks like this. I think you can see the topography there. You can see this is the mountainous area, this is the valley in here, and frankly, the walls of the city are right there. And if you can imagine, you know, they're going up the slope, so you put these walls on this upward slope, you try to attack it. It's a hard thing to do. It's an easy place to defend the city. But there's one small problem. Where's the Gihon Spring? Where is the source of water for the city? It's outside the city walls. Yeah, this is a huge problem because when a siege comes, the strategy of a siege is we will, you know, put our armies around you and you can't come out or go in. So whatever food and water you had before the siege is all the water you're going to have and all the food you're going to have. So we just kind of starve you out. So if your water source is outside, that's a bad thing. You just can't say, time out. Can you guys just kind of look the other way while we come out and get the water and then go back in? And the other army would say, no, we're not going to do that. So what we think happened is we've seen not we have, but archaeologists think they may have found foundations to some walls. Maybe the wall came out like this around it, or maybe there was something dug underneath so that they could then dig a well down. Notice this very accurate red work. It's hard to do that. You know, you can't, it's hard to draw with this thing. Does that say my or hi? It does say hi. Very impressive, isn't it? Sorry, I'm distracted. The Gihon Spring. Why is Ahaz out there? Ahaz is out there because he is the commander-in-chief, so before the enemy comes, he has to inspect this water source. So it's a very teachable moment, right? He's thinking about the siege, trying to get ready for the siege, and that's where Isaiah goes out to him, and Isaiah says, listen, I got a deal for you, and here is the deal. Isaiah says to him, take care and be calm, have no fear and do not be faint-hearted because of these two stubs of smoldering firebrands, a real condescending way to talk about the two kings. On account of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram, the son of Remaliah, Pekah. Don't worry about these guys. They're just smoldering firebrands. They're not a big fire that's going to consume you. They're just smoking things, okay? So, because Aram, that is Syria, and Ephraim, northern tribes, and son of Remaliah has planned evil against you, saying, let's go up against Judah and terrorize it and make for ourselves a breach in its walls. Don't be worried about them. They've said they're going to overwhelm you, but don't worry about it. You know why? Because thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. So Ahaz is out there by the spring, getting ready for the invasion. Isaiah goes out to him and says, listen, God has told you, you don't have to be concerned here. He will take care of you. If you put your trust in him, God will protect you from these two nations. So at that point then, Ahaz has a choice. His choice is very simple. I can listen to the words of Isaiah, I can believe him and not worry and put my faith in God, or I can take choice B. I can choose plan B, which is don't trust God, trust somebody else. And guess which one he does. He says, I want somebody with skin on. I'm going to choose plan B. I'm not going to trust God. I'm going to trust somebody else. So take a wild guess who he trusts. What he does is he gets on the telephone and he calls Assyria and says, hey, I got a problem. In fact, I got two little problems, Syria and Israel. Would you come take care of them for me? And the king of Assyria, whose name is Tiglath-Pileser III, affectionately known by his friends as TP3, okay, he says, sure, no problem. What are friends for? I'll come down and take care of these two little problems for you. And so he does. And after he comes down, the map then looks like this. You see? Syria is taken away, and the northern 10 tribes are taken away into captivity, never to be heard of again. Sort of, yeah. So this is when that time happens. And what happens then is that Syria and Israel are gone, but Judah is now subjugated to Assyria. So now we pay this high political price. We have to pay economic tribute. We have to worship their gods. And so we're not independent politically or economically or spiritually. It's a bad move. It's a stupid move. It's a dumb move. Why did it happen? It happened because Ahaz decided, I will put my trust in Assyria rather than in God. Right? So I mean, you can make applications in your own life, you know. As you make decisions, as you choose your values, are you choosing your values from what the other culture, what the nations choose, or do you put your trust in God's values? So what happens in the book then is this. The answer to this problem comes in 13 to 35, and very quickly it is, listen, Ahaz, God is to be trusted, not the other nations, and here's why. If you take a look at this, God is the one who is sovereign, and he will judge the other nations. So the idea of these chapters is, do you really want to put your trust in other nations? Here's how they'll come to an end. And what you have in 13 to 35 is chapter after chapter after chapter of how God will judge those other nations. You might think they're really seductive. You might think they're really powerful. You might think they're really what you want to be, but God will bring an end to them. God will destroy them. And if that's the kind of place you draw your values from, if that's where you draw your security from, you're going to end up just like they will. And by the way, would you like to know how they're going to end up? Well, let me tell you. Chapter 34 is the summary. The summary of how these other nations will end up, you can say it one of two ways. You can say either the desert or Armageddon. As you take a look at the verses here in chapter 34, they are verses of judgments. Come near, you nations, and listen. Pay attention, you peoples, and hear what's going to happen. God is going to destroy the nations. But notice these words. Their slain will be thrown out. Their dead bodies will send up a stench. The mountains will be soaked with their blood. All the stars of the heavens will be dissolved. And the sky rolled up like a scroll, and the starry host will fall. But what does that sound like to you? What other book in the Bible does this sound like? If you didn't know this was Isaiah, you'd think it might be the book of... probably Revelation, yeah. Most of you are there. Why? Well, because Revelation is about Armageddon. And Armageddon is first spoken of here in the book of Isaiah, chapter 34. So is this where you want to end up? Do you want to end up as an object of God's wrath? Or would you rather end up in chapter 35, the next chapter, which talks about the wisdom of trusting God, and here's where you will end up if you put your trust in God. You'll end up in the kingdom, not Armageddon. It's a much better place to be, okay? Let me show you why. In the kingdom, after Armageddon, when those who put their trust in God are left over, here's what things will be like. First of all, the desert and the parched land will be glad. The wilderness will rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It'll burst into bloom. It will greatly rejoice and shout for joy, and the glory of Lebanon will be given to it. The glory of Lebanon, as it's up on the coast, the Mediterranean moisture comes, and it's a beautiful, lush forest area, much like the Pacific Northwest. If you've ever been out there and seen the sequoias and the beautiful trees, it's just it's great. And they will see the glory of the Lord, the splendor of our God. Here's what Israel looks like now. Not exactly glorious, is it? Not exactly a desert. I mean, not exactly a forest. The only people who live in most of Israel or live in this kind of area are guys like this, you know, because as you practice, you can't hurt anybody because nothing's alive out there anyway. And what God is saying is this desert place that you find in Israel now is going to bloom like a garden because the curse will be reversed. And here again, it says, the eyes of the blind will be opened, the ears of the deaf will be unstopped. Then the lame will leap like a deer, the mute tongue will shout for joy. Water will gush forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The burning sand will become a pool, the thirsty ground bubbling springs. So what it's saying is, if you put your trust in God, you're going to end up in this situation here rather than Armageddon. And if you have half a brain, you choose, I'd rather be here. This looks good. Where diseases are taken care of and the curse is gone, this looks really, really good. Isaiah chapter 11 talks about the same thing. These are just some classic passages about what Messiah will bring about. Have you seen this before? Wolf will live with a lamb, leopard will lie down with a goat, calf and a lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. So in the kingdom, you'll be able to look down the street and there will be a little calf and a lion and a little kid will be leading them. Not only that, but the cow will feed with a bear and the young lion will lie down together. So you got these passive animals along with these formerly aggressive animals and they're getting along. And I don't think this is just a metaphor about people. I think we're talking about real live animals here, okay? The lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the hole of the cobra, and the young child put his hand into the viper's nest. Now, right now, that's a really scary, ugly thought, right? You know, especially if you don't like snakes. And I hate snakes. I'm sure Indiana Jones is repulsive, revulsion for snakes. I don't like them. And do you think about that? It's ugly. But in the kingdom, the situation will be so reversed, and snakes will be such friendly, happy, nice little animals like they're supposed to be, that a couple can say, oh, it's Friday night, let's go out. And the mother will say, oh, we don't have any babysitters. And the father will say, oh, no, the snakes will watch them, okay? Leave the kids home with the snakes, and the snakes will take care of the kids. Being a little facetious here, but you get the idea, right? Nothing will harm anything. And I look forward to this because I think that even in the New Testament, when Jesus does his miracles, like walking on the water, there's a lot of lesson to be taught there. It's not just a miracle. It's an example of what life will be like in the kingdom, where the whole earth will be protected, and the earth and the will support life and not take life, so that water will not take your life, and you'll be able to walk on it in the kingdom. Right? I'm thinking. I'm not sure about that, but that's pretty much my guess. So, well, what if you want to swim? I don't know. God will work that out too. So you can swim if you want to, but you can't drown. Okay? Life will be good. So which would you rather be, in Armageddon, where life is taken away, or would you rather be here, where life is supported? And I think I'd rather be there. Okay? So God's always on the side of life. Like this, lion and the lamb laying down together. Neat picture, isn't it? Can't tell you what happened after it was taken. Yeah?
I have a question.
Yep.
This is in like the new heaven and the new earth, right? It's not during the 1,000-year reign?
This is probably the 1,000-year reign we're thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But I don't think the new heavens and new earth are going to be a lot different than this.
Okay.
Do you want to ask more, or is that...
No,
okay.
Just, in reading it, I can't tell if it was talking about the 1,000-year reign.
Yeah, and it's also hard. Remember the mountaintop thing we looked at, too?
Uh-huh.
It's sometimes hard to know which is which there. But I think this is a lot of the future is going to be like this.
Is this the New Covenant, Jeremiah 31?
Yeah, exactly. Jeremiah 31. This is another part of what the New Covenant is going to be like. Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. Okay, well, that's the first half of the book, I think, at this point. I don't know if this works or not. We'll try it. Oh. Yes. Okay, it has absolutely nothing to do with class at all, but I thought I'd show it. Okay, so let's go on to the second part, which is this. 3A, the glory of Yahweh, the goal of servanthood. Now, the first one was the basis of servanthood. If you're going to have a foundation for being a servant, you got to trust. But once you trust, it's not simply, okay, now you're good to go, but now you're good to go do something else. And that something else is the goal, and that is showing the glory of God, giving off His glory, magnifying His name, telling people about Him. All right? So, let's take a look at this section. And again, we start out with the historical introduction, one of the kings of Israel, and now Ahaz is dead, and Hezekiah, his son, has taken over. So here we are. In the 14th year of King Hezekiah's reign, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, attacked all the fortified cities of Judah and captured them. He did that because Hezekiah rebelled against his overlord, Sennacherib, and said, "We're tired of being politically dependent upon you. We're tired of being economically tied to you and sending tribute money to you. We don't want to worship your gods. We want to worship Yahweh, our own God, in our own way, and we're rebelling." And so he says, "Okay. We'll see about that." And he comes down and he captures a lot of the cities of Israel, and his last one to go to is Jerusalem. So when the commander stopped at the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the washerman's field, again, same place, the Gihon Spring. So you have the very same situation presented here. Assyria comes down, it's ready to attack Jerusalem. The time period is 701 B.C. The king, or the general's name, is Sennacherib. And he has taken 46 cities in Judah, and there's one to go. And that's why Hezekiah has a crisis on his hands, similar to what Ahaz did. So, here's the way it goes. Very different story. When King Hezekiah heard this, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and went into the temple of the Lord. Already you can see a huge difference, right? Big difference between Hezekiah's reaction and the way his father Ahaz reacted. So, make a long story short, verse 20, Hezekiah prays, "Now, O Lord, our God, deliver us from his hand so that all kingdoms on earth may know that you alone, O Lord, are God." So, Hezekiah decides not to put the trust in some other nation. Hezekiah decides by prayer and faith to put his trust in God and see what the outcome will be. It's always a good choice, and God does have a pretty miraculous outcome, which looks like this. Then the angel of the Lord went forth and smote in the camp the Assyrians 185,000. I just like the way the King James says it here. 185,000. And when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. I'm not sure quite sure how to take that. You know, they all wake up in the morning and say, man, you look bad. Yeah, you do too, you look dead. Okay, so that is when the people of Jerusalem woke up, then all the 185,000 were dead around them. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and said, man, this is no longer any fun. All my army is dead, so I will go back to Nineveh. Now, obviously it's a huge victory at this point. Excuse me. But it gets even better, because what happens next is this. Verse 38, one day while he was worshiping in the temple of his god Nisroch, his sons Adrammelech and Sherezer cut him down with a sword, and they escaped the land of Ararat, and Esarhaddon and his sons succeeded him as king. Now, if you think that's just a minor little historical footnote, think again. Because if you know a little bit of the culture and the religion of the time, that's a huge theological statement. Do you understand why this is so important? The reason it's important is because the guy gets killed in his temple. Now, the way people conceived of their gods was this. The god lived in his home, in his temple, right? And his power kind of radiated out from there like a radio station, right? Like the waves of the radio station. So the further away you get from your home, the less powerful you can be. And it's understandable then that the god of Sennacherib might lose over there in Jerusalem, because you're far, far away, you know, the signal gets weak, so to speak, and so it's understandable that he could not be victorious over there. So God says, oh yeah, you think that's really the problem? We'll let the guy go back to his own temple and see if his God can protect him in his own temple. And the answer is, no. So he said, well, at least the guys who killed him, a vengeance was taken against them, right? And the answer is, no. They fled and they were escaped to the land of Ararat and didn't even take vengeance. So what this is saying is, this is a huge, huge theological victory on God's part and a horrible defeat on the part of their God. And all of it happens, why? Because Hezekiah says, let me trust, and it's a total, total victory. So it's not just a light historical footnote, but a huge theological statement about the victory won by Hezekiah because he made the right choice and trusted God rather than the nations. All right? So far, so good? Now, Hezekiah does well there, but he doesn't do well in chapter 38. We have one more story to present, and that's this one. In those days was Hezekiah sick unto death, and Isaiah the prophet, son of Amoz, came unto him and said unto him, thus says the Lord, set your house in order, for thou shalt die and not live. Just in case you're slow, you will die, and beyond that, here's what's worse, you're not going to live. Ooh. Oh. You know, it's like, it's in case the first news doesn't get you, the second news will. Just a typical kind of Hebrew parallelism. So what Hezekiah does then is he cries out, he starts to moan and cry and cries to God and says, I don't want to die, I don't want to die, please, I don't want to die. And God says, okay, I'll let you live. Now, this is kind of an interesting story, because I'm not so sure he should have prayed that prayer. What happens is, he has a son named Manasseh who turns out to be the most wicked son the wicked king Israel ever had. So maybe he'd been better off to die right here. But anyway, God does give him life, and here's how it happens. The word of the Lord came to Isaiah, go and tell Hezekiah, this is what the Lord, the God of your father David, says. I've heard your prayer and seen your tears. I will add 15 years to your life. And so he also gives him a sign to know that he will live another 15 years, and it's this. This is the Lord's sign to you that the Lord will do what he's promised. I'll make the shadow cast by the sun go back the 10 steps it has gone down on the stairway of Ahaz. So the sunlight went back the 10 steps it had gone down. I take it the picture is something like this. Hezekiah is sitting there on his deathbed, and Isaiah says, God is going to raise you up, and just to make sure you know that, then, you know, you've got these steps out here, and the sun is coming down, and the shadow has come up to here. Well, the shadow is going to recede again, and the sun's going to go backwards, right? Pretty huge miracle. I don't know exactly how God does it, but God makes the rules of nature. He can break them too, so he does that. I take it also that you can see this miracle all around the world. I don't know for sure, but at least this raising him up from his deathbed gets a lot of international attention. So what happens is this. At that time, Merodach Baladan, son of Baladan, the king of Babylon, sent Hezekiah letters and a gift because he'd heard of his illness and recovery. So here's the deal. You got these pagans from Babylon, and we all know what Babylon's going to do in the future, right? It's not a good thing. Wouldn't it have been cool if someone could have thwarted Babylon before they became such a powerful pagan nation and had a good Christian witness to them? Wouldn't that have been neat? Take a look at what happens here. So these envoys come from Babylon. Hezekiah received the envoys gladly and showed them what was in his storehouses, the silver and the gold and the spices and the fine oil, his entire armory and everything found among his treasures. Does that seem just a little bit unbalanced to you? Hey, we heard you were on your deathbed and you recovered. What about that? What happened? Oh, look at my gold. Look at my silver. Do you understand why this is just a little bit disappointing to someone who is watching from the outside? He shows them all of his stuff. Verse 4, the prophet asks, what did they see in your palace? Oh, they saw everything in my palace, Hezekiah said. There's nothing among my treasures, the things that I really value in life, that I did not show them. Oh yeah? Really? Yeah. I showed them all my gold. Is that what you value most? Is that the biggest treasure you have? Is that the secret to life, Hezekiah? Did you ever think about telling them about maybe your God? And my guess is that things got very quiet at that point. Because he didn't. Has he been a good servant or has he not been a good servant? And 2 Chronicles is even harder on him because 2 Chronicles says this, when the envoys were sent by the rulers of Babylon to ask him about the miraculous sign that had occurred in the land, God left him to test him and to know everything that was in his heart, but Hezekiah's heart was proud and he gave no return to the kindness shown to him. The point is here that when it came to trusting in God, Hezekiah did all right. But when it came time to telling of the glory of God, of the person of God, Hezekiah had this beautiful opportunity to tell some pagans from another land, and he completely blew it. So, to put the forest back in here, the big picture is this. There are two questions about serving God. When Ahaz was asked, shall we trust God, how did he answer it? Pretty badly, right? Ahaz was never even asked the question, shall we glorify God? When Hezekiah was asked the question, shall we trust God, how did he answer it? Very well. He was good at trusting God. When he was asked the question, shall we glorify God, what did he do? Pretty badly, right? So Ahaz fails in the first question. Hezekiah fails in the second question. And both of them are important. If you want to be a good servant of God, you've got to be able to trust him and to tell about him. And that kind of brings the book together here. And what you're going to see then in the chapters beyond this, chapters 40 to 66, are all sorts of emphasis upon telling about God and giving God his glory, that God's name would be magnified. Just a couple of verses that talk about that are these. Isaiah chapter 40. The voice of one calling in the desert, prepare the way for the Lord. Make straight in the wilderness a highway for our God. Every valley shall be raised up and every mountain and hill be made low. Who does that sound like? Do you remember who that is? Those are the words of John the Baptizer. He's preparing the way for Jesus so that, verse 5, and the glory of the Lord will be revealed. Do you know how the glory of the Lord is revealed? It's through a person, through Jesus. Jesus demonstrates the glory of God. And John the Baptizer comes, and Jesus explains his glory and is a true witness, right? And gives glory to God. Then there are verses like these. I am the Lord, that's my name. I will not give my glory to another. Isaiah 44. He displays his glory in Israel. Isaiah 48. I will not yield my glory to another. So all of these chapters are about telling and giving glory to God. That's what we're here for. Even in Isaiah 66, the same kind of thing. Now, there's one more thing. I need to tell you about, and it is these servant songs. These are poems or songs in the latter half of Isaiah about the ultimate servant. They are chapters 42, 49, 50, and 52 to 53. And you may have heard about them before. These are songs or poems that refer to the ultimate servant, to Messiah. Descriptions of Messiah, the ultimate servant, who trusts and who tells. And these are just absolutely classic passages and prophecies about Jesus, who, like Isaiah, both trusted and told about who God is. Now, we won't look at 42, 49, or 50, but in 52 to 53 is just some of the richest prophecy and the sweetest words in the whole book of Isaiah. It's like you step into the Holy of Holies here. See, my servant will act wisely. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. And the book of John talks a lot about this in John chapter 3, about Jesus being lifted up and highly exalted. And it's a pun in John's terms. Not only is he exalted, but he's lifted up physically on the cross. Just as there were many who were appalled at him, his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any man, and his form marred beyond human likeness. Now, right there in Isaiah 52, kind of get a little bit of a justification for the passion of the Christ. Right? Because there it says that at the crucifixion, his form is marred so much that if you were to see him, you'd say, is that thing human? And he's so beaten up. And that's when he sprinkles many nations with his blood, or that's where the atonement takes place. So that kind of talks immediately about the atonement in Isaiah 52. But then it goes back and talks about kind of a flashback in Jesus' life. He grew up before him. That is, Jesus grows up before God like a tender shoot, like a root out of a dry ground, like a place you wouldn't expect him. And even when he appears in the scene, Nathanael, who is an Israelite in whom there is no guile, says, can anything good come out of Nazareth? What? Can a Messiah come out of Nazareth? That just doesn't seem quite right, because Nazareth is, you know, a place up there that's a Roman outpost, and it's from Galilee of the Gentiles. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. So whatever pictures you see of Jesus, if they are, you know, that of a very good-looking first century man, they're probably not very accurate. Because the text says, there's no beauty or majesty to attract us to him. That is, Jesus probably looked like most of us, you know. I don't know if he was a homely person, but not someone you'd look at and say, man, I want to be just like him. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. I mean, just look at the beautiful poetry here. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. So if you can just sort of imagine a guy who's all beaten up and bloody and striped, and a guy who is fresh and clean and whole, Jesus, every time he gets beaten, every time a stripe is put on his back, one is taken off of the other guy. And every time he gets beaten and pierced and hurt, the other guy is made better. And that's kind of the picture given here. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. So there's the substitutionary part of the atonement, but then the unconditional love and the will comes in here when it says, he was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before his shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. Lambs are silent, thus the film title, Silence of the Lambs. Lambs are silent when they are killed. They're not like other animals that squeal, or like a pig that would squeal. And when Jesus stands before his trials, in his trials, stands before the governors, they ask him questions. Often he doesn't respond. And he easily could have gotten off if he had answered some of the questions that Herod or Pilate asked him. But he deliberately was quiet. You know why? Because if he'd spoken up, he might have been released. He didn't want to be released. He wanted to go and wanted to die. And that's why, as a sheep before shears is silent, he did not open his mouth so he could take the punishment. And finally, he was assigned a grave with the wicked. He should have been put in the potter's field. But he was with the rich in his death, buried in Joseph of Arimathea's tomb, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. So as you look at Isaiah 52 and 53, you got this beautiful picture, not just a prophecy of Messiah, but a picture of an ultimate servant who trusts and who tells, and corresponds to Isaiah, and is the antithesis, I guess, of the nation of Israel.